Talk Podcast, talking all things Disney, with your hosts, Eljon Go and Dave Bossert.
Welcome one and all to the Skull Rock Podcast, where every week we talk all things Disney and pop culture. We've never before heard stories, behind the scenes moments from some of your favorite Disney films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, and much more. I'm one of your co-hosts, Eljon Go, musician, longtime Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars fan, also pop culturist. And you can email me, Eljon, at skullrockpodcast.com. Dave is out of the office. He is out of the studio this week. However, we have virtual Dave joining us.
And I'm Dave Bossert, artist, filmmaker, author, and troublemaker. And welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, and Audible. You can like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you can also email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com.
And this week we have an amazing show lined up for you. We've got one of three. This is the first in three with legendary Disney producer Don Hahn. We're going to be talking about the Beauty and the Beast 30th anniversary this week, with all kinds of great stories behind the scenes, as you know and love from this show. And we encourage you to please sign up and subscribe to our show and share it with all your friends out there.
Skull Rock Podcast, ripped from the headlines. It's Skull Rock Podcast headline news.
Well, movies, as we talk about here on the show. Candyman towers the box office with an impressive $22 million debut, that is according to Variety. It was the top of the box office charts here domestically. It was in about 3,500 theaters the first 3 days of release, making all kinds of dough. This is a brand new slasher film written by Jordan Peele and directed by Captain Marvel 2 filmmaker Nia DaCosta. Surpassed industry expectations despite everything going on with the Delta. And I'm a big Jordan Peele fan, so I'm definitely looking forward to checking this out, as I am a horror movie buff. The film, Candyman, the reboot, cost $25 million to produce. MGM financed and produced the film while Universal handled the marketing and distribution. So pretty cool there. In recent weeks, new releases like Candyman and the Ryan Reynolds-led Free Guy and Paramount's animated adventure Paw Patrol sold more movie tickets than expected. So the box office is growing. It's pacing roughly 50% behind the same period in 2019. Cinema operators are eager to show Marvel's Shang-Chi, Legend of the Ten Rings, which opens next weekend and marks the first theatrical-only MCU release in more than 2 years. So we will be following that story closely. Virtual Dave, what did you think?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, that's incredible.
From Market Watch, Target prepares for the holidays with expanded Disney partnerships and more toy exclusives. The retailer expanding its partnership with Disney to bring more than 160 Disney shops to Target locations across the country. Target also plans to expand the online Disney shop. Target stock is up 43.1%. Over the year to date, Disney shares have slipped 1.9%. And that's something else, considering that my local Disney outlet store is closing. I think they're closing 60 locations around the United States. And it is a shame to see those stores go. And of course, I hate to see people losing their jobs, but it will be interesting to see how this partnership continues to grow and evolve. We knew about the partnership with Target stores at D23 Expo several years ago, and I had a feeling they were going to do more store within a store. Well, not a feeling, but they did talk about store within a store concepts popping up across the United States ever since that partnership started. So the holidays will be big and bright at Target with all that Disney merch.
Wow, that's incredible.
Marvel Studios dropped Spider-Man No Way Home trailer this week, broke the internet. Comes out this Christmas, but we have the audio here for you. Let's check it out.
Oh, look at this. This is a good one. Some suggest that Parker's powers include the male spider's ability to hypnotize females.
Stop. Come on.
Yes, my spider lord.
Can we just, like, stay up here all day? It is so crazy down there.
That's right, folks. Spider-Man is, in fact, Peter Parker.
Listen, I did not kill Mysterio. The drones did.
The drones that are yours.
Does any part of you feel relieved about all this?
What do you mean?
Now that everybody knows, you don't really have to hide or lie to people.
For the record, I never wanted to lie to you. But how do you tell someone that you're Spider-Man?
Now everybody knows.
But this isn't about me. This is hurting a lot of people. I've just been thinking about how to fix all of this.
So, Peter, what do I owe the pleasure?
I'm sorry to bother you, sir.
Please, we saved half the universe together. I think we're beyond you calling me, sir.
Okay, Steven.
That feels weird, but I'll allow it.
When Mysterio revealed my identity, my entire life got screwed up. I was wondering if maybe you could make it so that he never did.
Strange.
Don't cast that spell. It's too dangerous. Fine. I won't.
The entire world is about to forget that Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
Wait, everyone? Can't some people still know?
That's not how the spell works.
So MJ's gonna forget about everything we've ever been through?
Stop tampering with the spell.
Oh my God, Ned, he's my best friend.
Well, my Aunt May should believe you.
Stop talking.
What just happened?
We tampered with the stability of space-time. Multiverse is a concept about which we know frighteningly little. The problem is you trying to live two different lives. The longer you do it, the more dangerous it becomes.
Be careful what you wish for, Parker.
Hello, Peter.
Marissa Tomei, Aunt May, Peter Parker's aunt from Spider-Man No Way Home, took to social media. She thanks all the fans for their support of the new trailer, Spider-Man No Way Home, of course, from Marvel Studios. It hit huge numbers. It went totally viral. It crushed every other, even Marvel's Endgame, Marvel Studios Endgame trailer, 350 million views in just 24 hours. Absolutely amazing. The trailer I've seen so many times. But anyway, she says, I've been flying high for the last 10 hours, so I actually didn't post a trailer. My brother Harry did, so I haven't been able to see the reactions and how excited everyone is. I've just turned my phone on and my phone has gone mental. The love and support you guys have shown for the film is so exciting. Honestly, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You have no idea what else is to come. I'm so excited to share more with you guys. It feels so good to be back with Spider-Man, to be showing you trailers, to be having the films come out. This is so exciting. I love you all. Thank you for the support and enjoy the trailer. So thank you, Marissa. That's awesome news. Can't wait to go see the new Spider-Man.
Hey, I'm going to go see that.
Spider-Man No Way Home from Marvel Studios hits theaters this Christmas. Letitia Wright was injured on set of Black Panther Wakanda Forever earlier this week.
No. Are you serious?
She was briefly hospitalized in Boston on Wednesday with minor injuries after an incident on the set filming a stunt for the sequel, Black Panther Wakanda Forever. She was shortly released and no word on the extent of her injury. Being a huge Marvel Comics fan, I wanted to make sure to pay homage to the maestro of the Silver Age, the legendary Jack Kirby, Disney legend, the co-creator of influential characters for Marvel like the Fantastic Four, Hulk, Thor, and the X-Men. He had a legacy in comics that still stands tall today. And you could go ahead and check out the entire celebration of the King of Comics, Jack Kirby, there at Marvel.com. They've got little interviews, all the different characters and stuff that he's created over the years, featuring a really neat Silver Surfer and the Eternals, kind of tribute there. So please check out that article there at marvel.com and celebrate the King of Comics, Jack Kirby. In celebration of the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World Resort, ABC News and Disney Parks have teamed up to present a spectacular television event. It is The Most Magical Story on Earth. 50 years of Walt Disney World Resort, hosted by Disney legend Whoopi Goldberg, will take you on a complete story, a century, half a century and beyond at Walt Disney World in Florida, hosted by Disney legend Whoopi Goldberg. And we'll also have performances by Christina Aguilera, Halle Bailey, in front of the legendary Cinderella Castle at Magic Kingdom, accompanied by the renowned Orlando Philharmonic. Oh, Philharmonic Orchestra. And throughout the special, you'll see exclusive interviews with iconic actors, actresses, and athletes, cast members, Disney Imagineers from the past and present who played a unique part in that magic pixie dust that they sprinkle all over the world. And they will also have interviews, get this, interviews with Bob Chapek, Bob Iger, and Michael Eisner as they share favorite moments of Walt Disney World. So that's pretty cool.
Hey, you know, Al John, I have to say, that's kind of craziness.
I wonder if it's going to be archival footage. I hope it's all new footage. Also, celebrities include John Stamos, Gary Sinise, Melissa Joan Hart, Candace Cameron Bure, NFL athletes Tom Brady, Phil Simms, and Doug Williams, and the creative forces, the chiefs, if you will, Kevin Feige, Pete Docter, and James Cameron. They'll all be there. It's going to be super cool. Once again, catch this special on ABC, The Most Magical Story on Earth, 50 Years of Walt Disney World, airing Friday, October 1st at 8:10 p.m. Eastern on ABC. It can also be viewed the next day on demand on Hulu and later in the month on Disney Plus. Speaking of Disney Plus, don't forget to check out The Mandalorian Season 2 Finale, the Disney Gallery special. It is an amazing behind-the-scenes look at probably one of my most favorite moments of all time on TV.
This good feeling. Fundamentally, Star Wars should deliver a good feeling, an uplifting feeling in you and your family, your kids, whatever.
Disney Gallery, a little bit there from the wonderful Dave Filoni, executive producer, writer, creator, all that good stuff. Love Dave. Also on Disney Plus, Disney's Cruella, the movie event, is now available to stream on Disney Plus. So please check that out. It's an amazing movie. 2.5 hours of fun. So be sure to pack a lunch. Disney Plus has also revealed a brand new trailer and key art for Pixar Animation Studios' Doug Days, premiering September 1st, so please check that out.
I am Doug, and this makes me squirrel! I am warning you once again, but I will not warn you after that!
Doug!
Doug!
Get out of my azaleas!
I digged them!
Yeah, it's not dig, it's dug.
Yes?
No, you didn't dig, you dug.
I am Doug.
Pretty neat stuff. Bob Peterson, the voice of Doug, then and now, wrote and directed new shorts, and Kim Collins produces it. And very cool stuff indeed. His biggest series of adventures are all in his backyard, Disney Pixar Doug Days, streaming September 1st, just a few days away on Disney Plus. And in sad news, Ed Asner died at 91, well known for his role in Mary Tyler Moore Show. He also was the voice of Carl in the show Up, in the movie Up, Disney Pixar, just an amazing talent. In Twitter, his family had mentioned, quote, "We are sorry to say that our beloved patriarch had passed away this morning peacefully. Words cannot express the sadness we feel. With a kiss on your head, good night, Dad. We love you." Ed Asner died of natural causes in his home. And of course, he is known for all of his roles, as I mentioned, you know, Carl from Up, the Mary Tyler Moore Show as well. He won 7 Emmy Awards. And once again, just an incredible talent, and he will be missed. Speaking of incredible talents, also another sad note, Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones, the drummer who helped anchor one of rock's greatest rhythm sections, had also passed away. cherished husband and father, grandfather, member of the Rolling Stones, of course, one of the greatest drummers of his generation. Watts had announced that he would not tour with the Stones in 2021 because of an unidentified health issue. Very sad indeed. Charlie, once again, you will be missed. Charlie Watts dies at 80 years old. Thank you for that commentary, Virtual Dave, throughout the news segment. We do appreciate that wherever you are. But right now, let's go ahead and launch into our interview with the legendary Don Hahn, talking about the 30th anniversary of Disney's Beauty and the Beast.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
Well, Al John, as I promised at the top of the show, we've got an incredible guest, Don Hahn, who is a film producer who really is credited with producing some of the most successful animated films during the renaissance of Disney animation, including Beauty and the Beast, which was nominated for an Academy Award in Best Picture, the only animated film ever to be nominated for an Academy Award in the Best Picture category. He's also produced The Lion King, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Atlantis, Lost Empire, so many other films, but more importantly, he is a film director, an accomplished painter, a musician, and a book author. I mean, he is really a true Renaissance man. So let me just welcome Don Hahn to the Skull Rock Podcast.
And I'm an insomniac too, so.
All right, Don, it's so great to have you on the show. I really appreciate this. And I want to let our audience know first and foremost that today we're only going to talk about Beauty and the Beast. And then great, you're going to be with us next week to talk about The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Great.
And then the following week to talk about Atlantis, The Lost Empire, because all three of those films are celebrating anniversaries this year.
That's crazy.
It is nuts, isn't it?
It is, but you know, we'll do our best, and happy to talk about anything, and really happy to be on with you guys. I've listened to your podcast now because all my friends have contributed, and it's so great to actually be on and talking to you.
Well, it's great to have you, and I've said to so many of our guests that we can't possibly cover anybody's career in, like one episode of our podcast. And certainly with you, I don't even think we can cover your career in three episodes of our podcast, but I'm glad you brought your camping gear and you're camping out in our green room for the next 3 weeks so that we can record all these shows.
Happy to. Yeah. Happy to talk about any and all of it. And, if we run short, we can talk about some recipes I have that I'd like to share. And we'll just go on to other topics.
Fantastic. I think the one thing I'd sent you a note about, we exchanged emails, and I wanted to start out on Beauty and the Beast at the very beginning. And talk a little bit behind the scenes of, how this film got off the ground, and that it actually started with a director in London. Am I correct?
Yeah, it really did. You know, it started during Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I mean, you were working on that film too, and we were in London finishing up, and we had a difficult but great time and made a good movie. And so we wanted to keep some of the people together on that film. And I got a call from Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was kind of our studio boss at that time. And he said, we'd like you to try Beauty and the Beast. And I didn't think about it too much because I needed a job. But aside from that, I think the main thing about Beauty and the Beast was it was the last of the red hot fairy tales. You know, there was Cinderella, there was Sleeping Beauty, and Beauty and the Beast was kind of on the bookshelf, right next to those. So at first we dove in with, we were going to get Richard Williams to do it. The great Richard Williams, the animator who directed the animation on The Thief and the Cobbler and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. We asked Bob Zemeckis if he wanted to do it. And Richard Williams was the one who suggested Richard Purdom. Richard Purdom was a protege of Richard Williams, but much more than that. He had his own studio in London and was really kind of a brilliant animator, director. And his wife, Jill Thomas, was a producer. And as a team, they made a lot of sense to come in and try something new. And we had some luck in London with the talent over there. So we pulled Richard into our web. and started working on the film in London, which is a lot of people don't know. But we actually brought some people over from LA, like Andrea Esteja and Tom Cito and Glenn Keane. And it became a really, Gene Gilmore, a really intense time for us to, you know, start out in the movie.
Yeah, and that group actually got storyboards together in a story reel, if I recall correctly. I mean, there was some sort of presentation that culminated before there was a change in course.
Yeah, they really did. There was even an earlier group than that with people like Daryl Rooney and you know, several people in Los Angeles and Mel Shaw was always a part of that group. Mel, for those of you who don't know, was part of Bambi and had worked with Walt Disney way, way back, partly because he was a brilliant artist, but also because he was a great polo player and Walt needed him for his polo team. But more on that in the next episode. horsing around at Disney. But that group in London put together maybe 20 minutes, 22 minutes, of fully recorded, orchestrated, beautiful stuff. And I suppose the general consensus was it was working, but it was a little bit serious, a little bit European, a little bit like the Jean Cocteau version of Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. And wasn't quite firing off. And we actually, Richard Curtin and I brought it to Florida at the same time that Little Mermaid was coming out. I think it was the same week as the Little Mermaid press junket. And we sat in a room of executives and full of flop sweat. We were not the executives. And Roy Disney was there, Peter Schneider, Jeffrey Katzenberg. And we played it. And when the lights came up, I remember vividly the Jeffrey saying, you know, it's time to fish or cut bait. And those are, you know, you can look up that term, but it just basically means we're done. And, you know, I think that was a tough thing to hear, but it just wasn't firing off, particularly in light of the Little Mermaid, which was firing off and was a huge hit for all of its, you know, for the press and for everybody that was reacting to it. Part of that was John Musker, Ron Clements, the great people who wrote and conceived it. Part of it was Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, who wrote the songs for it. So it was just vibrant and alive and getting this great reaction. And Beauty and the Beast was anything but that. So we got back on the airplane and consumed a fair amount of in-flight beverages on our way back to London. And yet we had planned this trip to the Loire Valley in France. Now, those of you who don't know the Loire Valley in France, you can Google that right now, but it's the place for chateaus in France. And we had planned a research trip. So even though our movie was not shelved, but was certainly set back, in a bad way, we decided to go anyway. So we went on our trip to the Loire Valley.
You know, it's interesting when you compare that early version to The Little Mermaid. I mean, I view Little Mermaid as being this bright and fun and, you know, full of energy kind of picture. And that early version of Beauty and the Beast was really kind of dark in tone, wasn't it? Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, you just shut out for a minute, but you're back now.
Oh, okay. So let me, Aljon, I'm going to pick that up. So Don, when you look at The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, that version of it, like The Little Mermaid coming out was like bright and colorful and full of energy. And that early version, as I recall, of Beauty and the Beast was kind of on the dark side, wasn't it?
It was a little bit. And, you know, it's nobody's fault, particularly Richard Purdom, again, is a really brilliant guy. But Disney Animation was kind of finding its feet again after years and years. And so the idea of doing Beauty and the Beast, you had to kind of search because the second act of that story is very dark. You know, a father goes to a castle and picks a rose out of the beast's garden. And the beast says, well, now that you've picked a rose, bring me your firstborn daughter. Which is not a common thing we hear these days. So it becomes a really dark kind of almost inappropriate story. And so we had to throw it out. And the nice thing is the history of Walt Disney storytelling from Walt himself was to really throw things out and challenge things and not be too married to the core story of, say, Jungle Book or Cinderella or whatever. And so we felt somewhat empowered by that, particularly when we came back and started working with Howard Ashman and Alan Menken. We felt like, okay, now we have license to really throw it up in the air and create some kind of Disney magic with it all. And so the objects, the clock, teapot, candelabra type objects, were very serious in the earlier kind of London version. And they turned into singing and dancing and characters that were rooting for Belle and the Beast to get together. And of course, that's what made the story work, is your, not only did the Beast want to break the spell, but all the objects had a vested interest in the spell, and they had to break the spell too. And so now everybody's rooting interests are lined up, and Everybody has the same kind of goal in the movie.
Did when did Howard and Alan get involved with the project? Was it after that initial screening in Florida?
Yeah. It was right after that initial screening. And I think the aftermath of that is, we have Howard and Alan. They were working on Aladdin at the time. And Aladdin was having his story problems. And so lucky for us, Aladdin went into some story hell kind of rewrites. And so Howard and Alan were free. And thanks to Jeffrey Katzenberg and several different people, we kind of talked Howard into, well, you're not doing much and Beauty and the Beast is sitting right here. Why don't you jump in and help out on that show? And they did. I think Howard really took to it. He saw it a little bit as The King and I, two people from different worlds. And you have to remember Howard was just a student of musical theater. So he could look at a part of the movie or a song or a moment and just say, this is a lot like The Dancing King and I. This is a lot like this character in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. He could quote those things chapter and verse and really help frame some directions to try. And, it was one of his many gifts.
Was that, was the ballroom sequence essentially inspired by the King and I dancing?
Yeah, it really was. It's in a fairy tale or in a musical, characters rarely have sexual encounters, but they dance. And so the idea of consummating a romance is usually done in a dance, whether it's Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty or whatever. And those dances become very, very central then to the bonding of those characters. So just like in King and I, certainly the look and feel of that big ballroom and the big dress and everything else is inspired by The King and I.
Hmm. Did and I'm imagining Dick Purdom exited early on after that screening, didn't he? Or it was kind of a mutual thing, wasn't it? It really was.
Yeah. Again, this happens on movies where people don't quite connect with the material for whatever reason. And I think he connected with it, but was taking it in a direction that didn't feel particularly Disney, whatever the heck that is. Mm. So he worked with us for a while, worked with Howard for a while up in upstate New York where Howard lived. And then just said, I'm going to step back because it's not quite the movie I would make. And as the gentleman as he is, he and his wife Jill just stepped back and said, we're going to head back to London. They did. And we were left without a director, and we had to do kind of a battlefield promotion. And we looked around the studio and found two young story guys in their 20s and said, listen, why don't you guys try this? and you can be acting directors until we find somebody to really direct this movie. And that was Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale, who ended up directing it and many other fine movies. They're brilliant directors.
Yeah, we had Kirk on the show a couple of months ago, and it was just terrific to hear his perspective on all of those early days.
He got summoned with all of us to New York, and I was in New York already, and he said, well, you have to be in New York tomorrow and tomorrow morning and meet us in the boardroom of the Walt Disney Company, which is this giant, almost cartoon proportioned boardroom. And all of us animators sitting around like the country cousins, and the executives walked in and were like, good morning, Mr. Katzenberg. But it was good. Everybody was on the same page. Everybody wanted to make progress and dove into the new movie with the promise of, you know, making a better movie.
And what were some of the hurdles early on once Kirk and Gary got on board and Howard and Alan were already moving along on songs? Was it a true collaboration in your mind with everybody? I mean, you know, Howard was such a genius when it came to structuring a story with songs, because the songs moved the stories along. It wasn't like there was a song inserted for no apparent reason other than to have a song. It was a song that was part of the moving the story forward.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it was, the early days of putting it together, we of course listened to Howard and Alan because they were just off of many hits, including Little Shop of Horrors and Mermaid and whatever. But you have to remember, we also had a story team, not only our directors, but everybody on our story team then is now a director or has led a film in Hollywood. So you have Roger Allers, who went on to direct Lion King. You have Brenda Chapman, who went on to direct, a Pixar film. And you have Chris Sanders, who went on to direct
Brave.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Chris Sanders, who directed Lilo and Stitch and the Dragon movie at DreamWorks. And, so these tremendous talents who at the time were story artists. So you had a lot of power in the engine room on that particular show.
You had one version with the Purdoms that got torn down, and you're putting up another version, but there was still some various bits and parts of that sequences that were struggles, weren't there?
Yeah, there sure were. I mean, some of the original ideas, like the wolf chase, like Belle escaping from the castle and being tracked down by wolves and saved by the beast, that was saved in large part from the early Purdom version. And then there were a lot of other moments where you're just kind of fumbling through the forest without a flashlight and barefoot, hoping that you can find the path to get back on track to make your movie work. So having said that, there's things like the opening number was actually storyboarded and written. It wasn't written out like a song, but it was storyboarded by Bernie Mattinson, as I recall. And then we showed that to Howard and Alan, and they musicalized what was Belle going shopping, getting a loaf of bread, meeting Gaston, and made it into this amazing number. The same with Be Our Guest. You know, it was originally sung to Maurice, to Belle's father. And it was great. It was beautifully storyboarded, and Maurice was sitting at the table being served dinner. And during a story meeting, Bruce Woodside, one of our story guys, said, "You know, I think we're singing this to the wrong guy." And we all laughed and said, no. And he was right. Why weren't we singing Be Our Guest to Belle, the protagonist in the story? So we had a recording session really quickly and changed all of our pronouns and turned it into a song for Belle and reanimated a lot of that too. So
and that turned
into a lot of those.
Yeah, that turned into a spectacular sequence.
It really did,
sequence.
We were playing with computer graphics a little at the time. It was only 1990, 1991. Between that and the ballroom, there were little bits of computer graphics that allowed us to have more production values. But there's always bumps and grinds like that on a film. You know, there's never a smooth pathway. And if there is, there's probably something wrong with the film.
When you say that, it's so true about every single picture that you or I have been involved with over the decades. You are going along thinking everything's fine, and then you hit a speed bump and something's not working. You know, you're trying to believe it's working, but it really isn't working. And, you know, those fresh eyes that come in with executives saying, "Hey, that's not working," you know, or "you got to change that."
Yeah. You know, you end up really relying on those. We were lucky. We had good executives. We had the best situation is an executive who is open and understands that something's wrong, but doesn't necessarily know or want to fix it. So we had a lot of really good input from our executive team. Great story people with Peter Schneider, Tom Schumacher, Jeffrey Katzenberg. Michael Eisner was a good story guy. And it's not that we took his notes literally all the time, but he would have a good eye towards what was broken. Mm-hmm. And what wasn't firing off. And that's what you need when you're so close to a film or a painting, by the way, or a poem or a song. You have to back away after a while and just say, boy, I don't know where I am. Somebody help me.
You know, you mentioned Peter Schneider and Tom Schumacher. Both of those guys came from a theater background. So they really understood theater or musical theater. And what kind of impact do you think that had in those early years when those guys were first coming in?
Well, looking back on it, I think it had a really big impact. The studio came from an animation background or some sort of art background. I came from a music background, so I fit in pretty easily with the musicals and producing musicals. But a lot of times, if you come from purely an animation background, you may not have the story chops or the musical chops to be able to contribute on a level. And so to have executives and many people who came from the theater working on these movies, it provided a comfortable room for people to be in. And, you know, Peter Schneider was the company manager on Little Shop of Horrors in New York. So he's like a little kid, Peter, running around backstage with Howard Ashman writing those songs. And then years later, he becomes an executive at animation. So that background in theater is so American and so entertaining and so much about storytelling. That it was incredibly helpful and really educational, because I'm not sure we, meaning Disney animators, were that well-versed in musical storytelling before that point.
Yeah, no, and I agree. I mean, there certainly was a little bit of friction at the studio with the animation, with some of the people in animation and all of these theater folks coming in. I mean, I kind of recall that, you know, and that's kind of a natural thing, because there was so much change going on at that point that there were some people who were just getting their, you know, they were getting paranoid and, you know, they were, you know, trying to defend their position, if you will.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the other thing that was happening is it was a handoff between the old generation that started out with Walt Disney, Frank Thomas, Ward Kimball, Lolly Johnston, Barrick Larson, all those guys and girls, and a new generation. And then all of a sudden, all those people retired. So you look around, you go, hey, where's everybody? And all of a sudden, everyone's in their 20s and 30s. Hungry to prove that they could make a movie as good as that older generation. Whether we did or not is up to you to decide. But I think there was an ambition to do that. And then, the idea of we were just, you know, pushed off a lot at one point because the priority for the studio was to start a live action movie business. So to make room for that, we were over on Flower Street in Glendale opposite Imagineering, which was pretty cool, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was a chance for us to sink or swim. And I think we swam finally, but through many bumps. And, you know, animators, and I include myself in this statement, are suspicious of anyone new that comes into the business, are critical of any executive of any sort, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. It's very rare to have an executive that is, respected in some way. But I have to say, Peter Schneider, who was really our boss after a while, I've learned to really appreciate all he brought to it in terms of honesty and musical theater. Same for Jeffrey Katzenberg. Really, they're straight shooters, sometimes to the point where you don't want to hear what they have to say because they're being honest about it. But we all had to grow up. We had to grow up really fast.
Now, you said we were moved off the studio a lot. I like to say kicked off the studio a lot. I say that laughingly because it was kind of true. I think when the new management came in, they had no clue about animation whatsoever. So the natural thing to do was either shut it down, which they weren't going to be able to do because of our savior, Roy E. Disney. But moving us off the studio a lot and focusing on building that live action studio was certainly their big priority at that moment. I mean, you know, they had to get Cabin Boy done, you know.
Cabin Boy, they had to get Bette Midler in there. And you know, they were successful at it because the live action studio was a mixed bag. There were great films like Splash and that. But even though it might have been a priority for the studio under Ron Miller, it wasn't a huge, Disney, I felt like, was never part of Hollywood. And to me, that's a blessing because who wants to be part of Hollywood? But I think the idea that you could grow movies and have an active movie division as Katzenberg and Eisner and Wells did at Paramount was exciting on that level. But it did mean we were out on the street. I was in the middle of all that because I would go around looking for a new place for us. We almost ended up over by Ca del Sol, a beautiful restaurant in North Hollywood, in a little office building. And I'm glad we didn't take it, but we did plans and everything there. We almost ended up in the Hewlett-Packard building in North Hollywood because television animation was there. And then finally, there's these cheesy old warehouses by Imagineering on Flower Street. And we really went there for the access to Imagineering and their commissary. No joke. It's just that the infrastructure was there, the support mechanism, the wisdom of a lot of their Imagineers. And we felt like that was a really great place to go. So man, we packed up and moved.
I'm actually so glad that we moved over to Flower Street when we did.
Me too.
Because I was a morning person and I would go over to that commissary and that's where I met Claude Coates.
The story you tell about Claude Coates and sitting down and having breakfast with him frequently is amazing.
That to me was like, you know, and I was at the beginning of my career and he was at the tail end of this 50 plus year career. I mean, it was like when I met him, he was at the company for like 53 years and he was in the commissary. You know, I mean, when I would go like two or three times a week, I'd run into him in the commissary. And he'd always be getting a donut and black coffee.
Oh, man. That's a man after my own taste.
And you know, just an incredibly gracious, nice, approachable individual. And as a lot of the folks over at Imagineering were, I think they were kind of very welcoming to us and allowing us to participate in their Halloween parties that they did every year. I know some of them went off the rails because of
the police were called.
Of a few people in animation.
Yeah, there was law enforcement involved. Yeah.
but for the most part, they were, they were pretty gracious about it all.
I think all the guys from that generation were gracious. The men and women who grew up with Walt Disney were really generous with their training, and guys like Mark Davis and Eric Larson, Frank and Ollie, so many of the people of that generation really were generous to us. And I think that's now that I'm elderly, we're all elderly, getting to an age where we can give back. Like I get excited about the idea of giving back and whether it's teaching or writing or whatever, trying to share some of that knowledge back with upcoming generations.
Yeah. Going back to Beauty and the Beast, when we were in that one story warehouse building, it actually felt pretty good. I mean, there was a camaraderie in there. There was a family atmosphere in there because it was sort of this makeshift office space with, you know, cubicles being moved here and there and popped up, wherever we could stuff somebody at the peak of production. When you look back on the production, was there any period that was really kind of a tough moment, like getting the film done kind of moment? Because I think a lot of us who had worked on a number of pictures prior to that were sort of used to there being this, you know, fire drill at the end, you know, to get the movie finished. And a lot of the new people who were coming into production management from theater and things like that were like the blood was draining out of their heads. Like, oh my gosh, we're never going to get this movie done, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's true. Every movie's that way, which you said a while back. It's every movie's difficult and chaotic. And if it's not, there's something wrong. The movie right before us, Rescuers Down Under, is a really important movie because it was one of the first, if not the first, digital movies in Hollywood. And they had an impossible task of inventing a digital pipeline while they were making the movie. And Kathleen Gavin, who was the producer on that film, at one point just said, you know, it can't get done. We look at it on paper and look at all the schedules. There's no plausible way that that movie can get done, but we're not going to tell anybody that it can't get done. And it got done.
Yes.
And the kind of technology that was forged in that movie allowed Beauty and the Beast and Lion King and Aladdin and others to take off after that. And so the folks from theater learned fast. And I got to say, you know, we, meaning like I started in Disney animation in 1976 and I had been around for a while. I learned fast. I certainly didn't know anything about so many of the aspects of, you know, production management and that we had to do. And it was moving. So like every movie, Beauty and the Beast, we ran out of money at the end. The studio had a particularly bad year on the stock market. I remember putting scenes, stacks of drawings on the table in the conference room in Airway, which was our building that we had, and sitting there with the director saying, okay, the Beast has three stripes on his face. We can only afford two. Which two stripes do you want? And they would literally sit there and we finally got it down. Well, let's just do one stripe. And so we simplified. We would say, here's a scene that has a shadow. Does it need a shadow? Here, the Beast walks through water in this scene. Can we take the water out? So we were really doing, and you know this, Dave, as well as anybody, that yeah. The simplification pass of trying to keep the movie doable. And so it got down to the end and it was really simple. But it didn't hurt the movie. And the person I gave the most time to was Glenn Keane, because he was animating Belle and the Beast transformation, Belle and the Beast kissing, and mm-hmm. and that crucial kind of conclusion to the movie. If you were doing a third string beer mug or something, you didn't get a lot of time. You know, you had to turn it out. And we were so, this is telling tales out of school, but we were so out of time that the very last scene, which is Belle and the Beast dancing in the ballroom, we didn't have time to animate it. So I checked the scene out of the archives from Sleeping Beauty. And it's the scene of Aurora dancing with the prince when her dress is getting turned pink and blue. And Vera Lanfer, our kind of key cleanup head, changed it into the Belle and, you know, the Beast dancing in the ballroom. So if you put it side by side, Sleeping Beauty and Beauty and the Beast, that final scene, it's the same animation because we couldn't afford to finish the animation in a fresh way.
So somebody
saying that.
That's all right. But somebody actually posted something on the internet. It's got to be within the last couple of months. I saw a little YouTube video where they were putting some classic scenes next to some more contemporary scenes. And it was did you see that? Yeah, I thought that was great. And it's like, oh my God, you know, like the person, like the sense I got was that somebody was there saying, I've got you. I nailed you guys. I found out what you've been doing. And the reality was that in every one of our pictures, we were reusing material from all kinds of films. I can't tell you, just being in the special effects department, how much we reused the snow and rain that was shot for Bambi back in 1939-40. We were reusing that in Pocahontas, Little Mermaid. It was like, you know.
Well, it's a business. It's a business. Why put money into things that you have sitting on the shelf already? And Wooly Reitherman was the best at this. He would, on Fox and the Hound, he would say, we need some dogs at the very beginning chasing our lead characters. Go get the Bambi dogs. And so I'd go down and get these dogs running around from Bambi. And sure enough, we'd put them in the movie and they worked just fine. And there's nothing wrong with that, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I think the more we can reuse and economize, the more we can put more dollars and entertainment into places that really need it. And that's what it's about. That's what producing is about, is trying to put your efforts into places that make a difference.
Yeah. And you know something, Walt was a master at repurposing animation. I mean, he did it through the 30s and into the 40s and even into the 50s with television. They were constantly reusing and reworking. I mean, they reused material from Snow White to do war bond commercials and trailers for the theaters during the 40s. You know, you grab what you can in order to get the production done. And I was going to say the movie got done. That's the magnificent thing about it.
Yeah, nobody walked out of the theater. you know, that's the kind of crucial thing, is if you're emotionally engaged in the story, how you got there, which is usually chaotic and full of blood, sweat, and tears, doesn't matter as much as how invested you are in the story. And if you're invested in the story and you have suspended your disbelief to believe that this beast and this girl can fall in love, you're not going to care, you know, that the magic effects were animated by Ted Kiersey with a grease pencil. You're not going to care, although it's it's brilliant artistry. You shouldn't care. And that's the paradox of animation, is you spend all this time and money into making people forget that you spent all this time and money.
Yeah, no, it's very true. I have a vivid memory of coming into the office on Flower Street. I think it must have been the Monday after opening weekend of Beauty and the Beast, because there was this incredible bouquet of roses. It must have been like three dozen. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
sitting on the receptionist's sort of counter in front of her desk. I remember walking in and seeing that. And apparently, I think it was Jeffrey sending that over to the crew. Yeah. Because it was it was a massive opening weekend, and everybody at that point, it was like a sigh of relief, because everybody knew this was a hit.
It really was. And, you know, I think it's easy to say sometimes that, the executives didn't care about animation or whatever. But, you know, even when Black Cauldron came out, they threw us a big party. They screened it at the Academy. They took us to Chasen's for chili. When Beauty and the Beast came out, they ran the most spectacular Academy Awards kind of campaign, I guess would be the word for it, that included, a museum show at the Whitney in New York and a screening at the New York Film Festival, which had never been done before, of an incomplete version of the film, mainly to educate the audience, because nobody knew what, you know, an animation unfinished movie looked like. And, just with a lot of very clever marketing and deliberate kind of putting the movie out there, it really helped not only to make the movie successful, or at least get people to the theater, but eventually also to have the Academy acknowledge it for the first time, which is something Walt Disney didn't even get. So we were pretty humbled by all that, I think is the word.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think it's interesting, because it was really on that picture that the reports were coming back to the studio that the theater owners were filling up evening shows. For Beauty and the Beast. And Al John, if I'm correct, I think you took a date. Was it your wife or was it pre-wife?
It was a pre-wife date movie. And so thank you, Don, for that. We had a great time. Yeah, thank you. We had a great time. But I will say that when my wife and I were dating, unbeknownst to us, her favorite movie was Beauty and the Beast, and I was too. So we had our, back in the day, our chat room handles were Belle Loves the Beast and the Beast Loves Belle. So there you go.
Aw, that's really sweet.
And I am the Beast. Clearly, I am the Beast. Clearly.
Thank God you have no picture going along with this.
That's right. That's right.
Yes, it's true.
Unrefined. Unrefined. Yeah. Unrefined. That's me.
But this, you know, it was so amazing to hear those reports coming back that the evening theaters were, the showings were filling up with people, and it was dates. It was people going out on date night to see this movie, and that really what I think was a big boost for a lot of folks on the crew.
Yeah. It really was, because a few years earlier, you could not dream of a Disney animated film making more than a few, you know, maybe $10 or $20 million. And those were welcome dollars. There's nothing wrong with that. And certainly movies like 101 Dalmatians and Snow White, they're all-time blockbusters, still on the blockbuster list, but not the contemporary movies so much. So when these movies were seen by a general audience, and Little Mermaid kind of broke the ice on that, and before that, Roger Rabbit broke the ice on that, it reminded people how much they loved animation. And, so I think from Roger to Mermaid to Beauty to, you know, Aladdin and Lion King, Rescuers Down Under, all those films were really a build on each other's in terms of the excitement about the next feature coming up. The studio was in top form. It wasn't just the animation studio, it was the marketing department. It was the design of the posters. It was the TV campaigns. It was a really group effort. And the other thing that was happening at the same time was the international box office was growing. We forget that there was no international box office back then. You might get, you know, $13 from some theater in Guatemala, but it wasn't like it is now, where the largest portion of box office does come from international. So people like Mark Cerutti and Dick Cook were out there in distribution, really pounding the pavement around the world and trying to use this and movies like it to kind of open up doors for international box office for Disney.
Yeah. And you know, this film was huge through the holidays. And then on January 30th of 1992, it broke $100 million at the domestic box office. $100 million. That was the first animated film to break $100 million at the box office. I mean, Little Mermaid came close. I think it did like 89 million, but I mean, this is decisive. I mean, it crossed over the $100 million mark in 1992. Yeah. And I mean, just, you know, that had to have been, I know from being in the trenches at the studio, that was exciting. You know, because that was
really
like, people loved the movie, you know, and animation was back.
Yeah. And again, we stood on the shoulders of the movies like Little Mermaid that came before us. We were afraid of going after Little Mermaid because it was so good and so tight that we thought, well, if we can just kind of get up to that level in terms of the quality of what we're doing, then maybe we'll be okay. So when it exceeded that, it was unbelievable. And it's a real group effort. You know, that's the other funny thing about animation that I love, actually, is you can't say, oh, that's Don Hahn's movie, or that's, you know, it really is a team effort. And so when you have a success like that, you're not just pointing at a director saying, isn't that director a savant? Oh, my God, I wish I knew him. It's not that way at all in animation. You have a group of guys and girls who are collaborating, and without any particular one of those people, be they colorists or painters or animators or whatever, you would not have a movie. And it's one of the collegial things and communities that I love about animation more than anything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Go ahead.
I've got a question. So when the film takes its, you know, kind of final shape, is there a test screening that happens outside of the company where maybe the PR firm, or, you know, I know Disney handles their PR, you know, internally, but you guys do a press screening or test screening for people? And then do they come out going, this is amazing? Like, I didn't feel like it was a children's film, because it really hit so many different, you know, checked so many different boxes for people, and emotions and fun and joy and the music. I mean, did that happen? And if it did happen, what did you need? Did you need to change anything at all before it was released to the general public?
Well, it does happen. And it goes back to Walt Disney's day too, because in the, you know, 50s and 60s, they were doing the same thing. We took all of our movies out to test. The reason we could was there was no internet. If you took a movie out to test today, you have to be kind of careful where you take it, because it'll just be all over the place if people come to see it. That wasn't a problem then. So the advantage is you get feedback from the audience, both a written feedback, and then you hold back a group of maybe 20 people from the audience and ask questions. A lot of what you get from that is intuitive. You know, we'll sit there with Kirk and Gary, the directors, and you'll go, gee, you know, there was applause after this song. We never expected that. Let's add 3 seconds so that people can applaud if they want to, right. We had to wait too long. You know, when this line happened, the joke didn't work, so let's come up with a new joke or something like that. So you learn those little details. Sometimes you learn much bigger details, like on Maleficent, the early screenings were really good, but it took about 30 or 45 minutes for Angelina Jolie to show up. And the audience said, you know, it starts a little slow. That's because Angelina Jolie doesn't show up for 30 or 45 minutes. So we cut out the first 30 minutes of the movie. So now in the final movie, when it came out, she's right there in the beginning. So sometimes you learn those somewhat obvious things. The other thing we had to do was kind of train the audience what they were looking at. Because when we previewed it, the movie was in black and white or very few color scenes. Because the animated movies are mosaiced together. So you might have story sketches, which are, you know, kind of like comic strips laid out to tell the story. And then a rough animation piece, followed by a cleanup piece, followed by a color, followed by another story sketch. So we would inevitably stand up in front and say, let's show you a little progression reel so you know what you're looking at. And we would show that progress and try to educate the audience what they were seeing. And they got it. And the kids, of course, got it right away. And there was a time when we brought in fourth and fifth graders to see the movies, even before the audiences, the kind of general audiences, because they got it. They could look at anything and understand it and give us a good, like, super honest assessment of where the movie was.
Wow.
You know, like what's your least favorite character? Oh, it's Gaston. What's your favorite character? Gaston. Yeah, so, you know, so they were just like super honest about everything. And you want that. Yeah. You don't want people to come in and just say, oh, you're so great. Isn't it wonderful? I mean, boy, when you're making a movie, it's time to, you know, be honest about every aspect of it.
Well, that's really cool because, I mean, the kids, they'll tell you the honest truth. You know, whether you like it or not, they'll just go ahead and rip you or they'll just congratulate you and just be happy about it. So that's cool.
They sure do. They still do. So, you know, as movies went on, and we can talk about this at subsequent sessions, but as movies went on, we were really careful and we would actually fly to, you know, Phoenix or someplace where there wasn't such a big contingency of Hollywood families and kids. Because if you premiere it in the Valley or in Sherman Oaks or something, everybody in that neighborhood works for the movie industry.
Yeah.
And so you don't necessarily want that as your audience. You want just, you know, mom and dad and their kids and a genuine, you know, feedback of what works. And they started to like the movie. We showed it in Burbank once. Oh boy, we were, I don't think I've ever told this story. We were going to get Janet Jackson to sing the end credits song. Ooh. And, so we did a screening in Burbank for her with an audience. And we did what we call a Stallone start, which was invented during the Rocky movies, where the lights go down in the theater and then it's dark for a long time. People might think it's a technical problem. But what's happening is Sylvester Stallone, or in our case, Janet Jackson, sneaks into the back of the theater. And then you play the movie. And before the movie's over, she sneaks out. So it actually went really well. And nobody left during the movie. Usually there's kids running out to take a bathroom break or whatever. And in the notes session afterwards, Michael Eisner said, God, nobody left. I mean, nobody took a bathroom break. So we decided to put on the poster, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll hold your water.
I love it.
You know, it's interesting. We had Mike Gabriel on many months ago talking, and he mentioned this a test screening they did for Pocahontas. I think it was in Phoenix, too. The kids got fidgety in the audience when the song If I Never Knew You came on.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a very romantic moment with Pocahontas and John Smith. And Michael was like, we got to cut that song. The kids are getting restless and, you know, cut the song. And Mike was holding on for, you know, trying to keep that song in for, you know, for as long as he could. And then finally, after that screening, was sort of like, okay, we got to take it out. Fortunately, that song made it back in for a 10th anniversary release of Pocahontas on DVD. Now, the same thing kind of happened with Beauty and the Beast and the Human Again sequence. Can you talk about that whole Human Again sequence? And like from the beginning with the movie being made and then it being resurrected for the 10th anniversary?
I need a cocktail. It's many, many songs end up on the floor in the making of a movie, probably fewer than usual with Howard and Alan. And sadly, Howard was sick during a lot of the making of Beauty and the Beast. And so he had written a spectacular song that had to have been 10 minutes long called Human Again. And it was the object's point of view. And it made sense. It was a good idea to say, you know, here's all these objects that are in the chateaus, in the castle that have a rooting interest for this romance to work. Let's hear from them. In the context of a Broadway musical that lasts for 2.5 hours, it's perfect. In fact, it made it to the Broadway musical that lasts 2.5 hours. But in a 85 or 90 minute animated film, it was too far, too long away from Belle and the Beast, and just took too much of the attention away from our protagonists for too long. So the song was cut completely. I mean, we cut it from 10 minutes down to 7, down to 5, down to 3, down to like a couple of bars, and eventually it went and was replaced by a song called Something There, which Howard wrote, probably one of the last songs he ever wrote. Very sweet song between Belle and the Beast, and kind of a thought song where they're out in the snow singing. And then Hume Again went away until the Broadway show came out, and Alan found a way to resurrect it. And then eventually we re-recorded it with the original cast, which was a hoot, getting Jerry Orbach and you know, all the cast back together, Angela Lansbury,
David Ogden Stiers.
Oh, I mean, yeah, we could do a whole hour on the cast. And they came in and recorded it, and then we animated it with a lot of the original animators. And that was a kind of a bonus track on one of the Blu-ray releases or DVD releases not too long ago.
Yeah, yeah. That was actually kind of a lot of fun to be able to revisit that film 10 yeah. years later, and also not only put in the Human Again sequence, but also it allowed Kirk and Gary to kind of address their wish list of things they wanted to fix.
You know, that's a really good point. The movie got rushed out so much. There were scenes, literally scenes like the snowball fight in the Something There song that had no faces on the characters because we were moving so fast. So I said one day, you know, we're doing this. Why don't we make a list, a shopping list of things that if you could, we could fix if there's time. And it was one of the kind of happiest shopping lists I've ever made, because I think we got to do all of them and just fix it up a little bit without changing anything. We didn't add any, you know, scenes from Star Wars or anything, but we were able to, you know, just kind of fix up things that were broken in the original release. And as an audience, you might not think things were broken, but believe me, things were broken.
Yeah. And you know, for the artists working on a film, I mean, the running joke was always you never finished the movie. You just released it, because if the artists were left to their own devices, they would just continue to noodle and work it and keep, you know, improving it. And you have to at some point take it away and say, this has to go out to the theaters.
Yeah. They're never finished. They're only abandoned. Because you run out of time and money. I wish it was different, but you never reach a day where you go, now it is perfect. The audience may see it. And you know, it's good that you don't do that, because it forces you to put your efforts into the places that's important.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have seen films from directors who maybe did have 10 or 20 years to noodle away on a film, they're not necessarily better. They might be a personal expression of that person's artistry. But for a film like Beauty, it was better that we had deadlines.
Yeah. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, though, you had the shopping list, and we did do fixes on scenes outside of the Human Again sequence, which was being inserted for the 10th anniversary. But we also did an IMAX version of Beauty and the Beast, and there were additional scenes that had to be fixed for the IMAX screen. Am I yeah. right on that?
That's really true. You know, the IMAX screen is a different proportion than the regular movie screen. The movie screen is 16:9 ratio, roughly. And an IMAX screen is almost square. And so in some cases, we had to expand the painting in the background to add extra space above and below. And then a few years later, we did a 3D version of Beauty and the Beast.
That's right.
So every few years, something sweeps through the industry as a fresh idea. And, you know, luckily these movies can be adapted. And we did, in fact, do an IMAX and a 3D version and a 3D IMAX version of Beauty and the Beast before we were done.
It was pretty awesome, I think. You know, when you look back on the fact that Beauty and the Beast was nominated in the Best Picture category, it was the first time any animated film had ever been nominated in the Best Picture category. What was going through your head when that happened? And then what was it like going to the Academy Awards for that?
Well, I don't know that I ever processed or felt like anything other than kind of humbled by all that stuff. Hollywood puts so much pressure on pictures to be marketed as Best Picture and Academy Award winning And they never have really welcomed animation to that spot. It's not out of any ill will. It's just animation was never part of Hollywood. It was just a kind of side thing. In fact, a warm-up act for the main feature movies. So the shorts and the animation industry grows out of the stand-up comedian that used to warm up the audience before the main feature. So that's why animation's been slow to the Academy Awards. It was a huge effort and a huge acknowledgement to have Beauty and the Beast accepted. I wore a clean suit that night. I went to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, which is where the Academy Awards were at the time, and sat down in the seventh row, you know, behind Sylvester Stallone, behind Robert De Niro and things. And the main thing that goes through your head is, what am I doing here? I didn't go to school to be part of this. I am fortunate and blessed to be part of it. But it's just odd because it's such a different industry than the live action business. So I don't know. I would like to think the live action business has really welcomed animation, because today it is the most lucrative, hugely financially successful part of the movie business times 10.
And
it wasn't.
Yeah, but animation, I mean, is part of just about every big tentpole live action film that goes out there now. Yeah, I mean, if you look at any of those Marvel films, I mean, they're it's like, you know, a good percentage of those actors are actually animation.
Absolutely. Space Jam, so many films like that are animation. So it's a boom time today that comes in part from that era when Beauty and those movies were starting to blaze a path. But, you know, blaze a path that had, again, kind of followed the lead of some of the great characters that worked with Walt Disney a long time ago.
Now, were you outraged that Beauty did not win the Best Picture that year?
Here's a really weird thing. I got a call from, I think it was from Michael Eisner. He said, if it wins and you go up, if it wins, could you please say the following? Thank you to the Academy. And now I'm going to Disneyland. And I said, Michael, really? I have never told anyone this. I'm giving this to the Skull Rock podcast live here.
It's a Skull Rock podcast exclusive.
Yeah. And he's, you should put some echo on the word exclusive.
I will at post.
Thank you. And I said, Michael, I can't do that. And he said, no, it's just an easy thing. And maybe we'll give some money to the charity of your choice if you decide to do that. Well, no pressure. Here's the guy who's the chairman of the corporation asking you to put in a commercial for Disneyland in front of several million people that are watching the broadcast. So a small part of me is relieved we didn't win, because I wouldn't know what to do with that piece of information. I don't know. I had no expectation going into the evening. I think the nomination was unbelievable. And it's hard to wrangle Academy voters to line up on any particular film, much less an animated film. I've been a member of the Academy for 30 years and adore what the Academy does. But it's always a little bit of a work in progress. So not disappointed at all. Happy we were invited to the party. Literally invited to the party, because we went to the Golden Globes. We got a Golden Globe Award, which I think I have like right behind. You have no camera here, but I think I have it right behind my desk.
Well,
here.
We're recording this, but only the three of us will see it. Look at that.
Okay,
there's the Golden Globe.
It is the Beauty and the Beast Golden Globe. So I keep it in my trousers, actually, just in case I'm asked to pull it out.
Like the Spinal Tap episode, right?
It's, yeah. What's funny is when we were at the New York Film Festival, we were at the Alice Tully Hall screening to a packed house, standing ovations, all that kind of stuff. Beforehand, we were running around backstage, getting ready to go on and introduce the film. And Gary Trousdale, the director, turns around and says, this is totally Spinal Tap. And it was, because here's three guys from California at Lincoln Center, you know, and running around with their cartoon, getting ready to show it to a celebrity filled audience, including, you know, people like Don Johnson. And so it's just odd. You know, I think to a group of people who don't aspire to the celebrity and glitter of the Kardashian world, to be in that world is fascinating. And as an observer in that world, it's spectacular. But I'm sure glad to get back to Burbank.
It's a fish out of water type of moment. Yeah.
It totally is for everybody.
Now, Beauty was nominated, and this is when the Best Picture category was only 5 nominations.
Yeah.
Right? And one of them one of them was Beauty and the Beast. What do you remember what the other movies were, or do you remember which one won against?
Oh, I don't. And I won't embarrass myself by Googling them. Silence of the Lambs won because it was a great movie. Let's face it. Sure. So no problem there. But I don't remember the other nominees.
Yeah.
I hardly remember the Best Picture nominee from last year.
They didn't win. They didn't win. Why would we remember them? They didn't win.
They didn't. But you know, Alan and Howard won for their score, as they did for Little Mermaid.
And they won for a song, didn't they?
They did.
Yeah, so here you go. Yeah, so here you go. You got Bugsy, JFK, Prince of Tides, Beauty, and Silence of the Lambs at one.
Wow.
Those are some heavy
hitter films, right?
Yeah.
I remember when they announced the nominees, which they did at 5 or 6 in the morning so that the East Coast could have it. I got up early and made a coffee and sat there and watched TV. And when we heard our name announced, I squealed like there was no tomorrow, because it just was so amazing. And then the phone started to ring. And I answered and said, hi. And hi, it's Michael Eisner. Just want to say congratulations. Okay. And then the phone would ring it again. Hi, it's Roy Disney. Just want to say congratulations. And so these guys who were our cold-hearted executives, so to speak, were actually really warm-hearted about congratulating us and kind of offering their thanks to all of us who worked on that movie. And that was a great experience too, just that kind of inclusion that they had for us.
Awesome.
That is so fantastic. When you look back, I mean, this is the 30th anniversary of Beauty and the Beast this year. When you look back, I mean, what's the legacy of that movie? What do you think in terms of, you know, 100 years from now, somebody's going to look at that movie and be talking about it in a film school, maybe?
Wow. I think it's storytelling. You know, there may be better animation in other movies, for sure. There may be better, you know, what have you. But I think the storytelling in the context of a musical is really great in that movie. And, you know, the Library of Congress chose it to be part of their forever collection, along with Roger Rabbit. And so that's really humbling when that happens. But I think it's because of that. So I can really point to Howard Ashman, really point to Kirk Wise, Gary Trousdale, and all those story guys and girls who went on to direct, because the storytelling in that movie, same with Little Mermaid, is exquisite. And it just has to do with great structure, great progression of characters, strong emotional involvement in the characters and what they want in life. And then Howard was a stickler for putting the plot in the songs. You know, if ever there was a song that was just entertainment or kind of you stop for an FM radio song or something, he hated it, and rightly so. So every song and every moment in his films and his work is plot driven and beautifully so. Just examine the lyrics sometimes for the opening bell number, and every line has, you know, in what might have been a 10-minute opening number, in about 4 minutes, you meet the lead character. You see she's an outsider. She lives on the outside of town. You meet Gaston, the villain, his sidekick, LeFou. You meet the different people in town that are going to be her antagonists, all in the course of this little opening number. Beautiful. So I think all those things.
Opening. Yeah.
Beautiful operetta. So all those things, I think, add up to something that's hopefully memorable.
Are there any particular moments or funny stories that pop to you, pop in mind when you think of Beauty and the Beast and just the overall production of it? Was there any one or two things that just like were insane or, you know, crazy, funny?
We did a lot of parties just to blow off steam. And one of the best ones is I don't remember who it was. Maybe you do. had a massive slingshot, the kind that it's held by two people and then the center is pulled back by a third person. And we had leftover donuts from the morning and we went outside and saw how far we could hurl our long johns into the neighbor's yard. So that was one nice event. We had an opera contest, Jifui Bodo, who, if you may remember, brilliant animator on The Beast, would frequently stand on his desk and sing a indeterminate opera of indeterminate length. And many people would join in. And so that was always a happy time. You know, so a lot of our kind of parties and things like that were really just meant to blow off steam. Gary, the director, had a paintball gun he would occasionally bring inside. And I'll just stop that story there. You know, we were fairly young compared to most studios and had a good time because there was a lot of pressure during the making of the movie also. And there were, you know, we went up to upstate New York to work with Howard Ashman because he was not feeling well. We thought it was because he was just being a diva because he won an Oscar on Little Mermaid, but we later found out it's because he was HIV positive. So that was a mixed bag. It was freezing cold in the winter. We flew into New York and rented some cars and drove up to the beautiful Residence Inn in Fishkill, New York.
Well, yes, I know Fishkill. It's outside of Albany.
It is outside of Albany, and it's... Yeah. It's lovely on the Hudson.
It's the Sullivan County, I believe, is where Fishkill is. It's sort of the Catskills. You know, you start to get into the Catskills.
And Howard lived in Cold Spring on the Hudson. I rented a conference room there at the hotel, just the kind of conference room that maybe one would sell boilers at. And I got a rented piano for Alan, and Howard would come in and bring donuts, which is kind of a recurring theme on this movie. And we would work all day and, you know, kind of slog out these songs. And so that short time up in Fishkill was really important to the movie because we had just switched directors. The whole new team was on. The songs were starting to come through. And boy, when you get a song on an audio tape from Ashman and Menken, that's like the best day in your life. You know, you get a song like Be Our Guest or, you know, Belle or something. It's just stunning. So that's when the movie just starts to rise musically. And then you have this great cast of Angela Lansbury and Jerry Orbach and these Broadway superstars. That starts to elevate the movie. Then you start to see great work by Mark Henn or James Baxter or, you know, Lorna Cook or Glenn Keane, Andreas Deja. I try to like buy things for the animators to keep them motivated. Like I bought a full stuffed taxidermy bison head for Glenn Keane, just as inspiration for the bulk of the beast's head.
Yeah.
And I also got a Muscle and Fitness magazine subscriptions for Andreas Deja because he was doing guest on. So my expense reports were always interesting. It helped, you know, because you could go into Glenn's room and you could see this bison. You know, I would never do that today. It's kind of politically incorrect. But it would give you a sense of the weight of it all. Or sure. We would set up for Glenn to go to the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena and see, you know, the Burghers of Calais, that amazing Rodin sculpture, mm-hmm. which a lot of his gestures and kind of forms that he used in the transformation of the beast are based on that. So, you know, as a producer, you're trying to hire the best people you can and stay out of their way and do exactly what they tell you to do and try to cheerlead and put them in the path of inspiring things. And
I was going to while you were telling that story, I couldn't help but think that during that period, that sort of Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast period, there really was this transition happening of all those new executives that were coming in. Like they were getting comfortable and used to the idiosyncratic ways of the animation department and the sort of the craziness that went on in the animation department, wouldn't you say? I mean, yeah, you know, it seemed that way to me that I think initially people like Peter and Kathleen were like, didn't know what to make of some of the folks.
Yeah, it could be. But they, I think, adapted pretty quickly because being from theater, they had seen pretty much everything, I think. And yeah. And we're really, you know, good in the theater. I mean, Tom Schumacher and Peter ran the Olympic Arts Festival in part when it was in Los Angeles for the Olympics in 84, was that?
Yeah, 84 Olympics.
Yeah. So, you know, experienced guys and that combination of people from theater and the animation people really helped, along with Roy Disney. And it would be remiss if we didn't talk about Roy a little bit because he was a good friend and for both of us and a real ran interference for us when we needed that, kicked our butts when we needed that.
He was the godfather of the animation department. He really yeah. was because I think when the new management came in, I really believe they were going to shut down animation. They didn't mm-hmm. understand it. They were looking at the Black Cauldron, which wasn't in their eyes a great movie, and they were going to close down the animation department. And it really was Roy that stepped in and said, "No, this is the cornerstone of the company. If animation is well, the company is going to do well."
Yeah, that was absolutely the feeling back then, and hopefully still now. I mean, when something like Frozen takes off at the box office, it bodes well for the whole company.
Yeah.
So Roy really was that to all of us, and was a defender when we needed it, and then had aspirations of his own, and that's where Fantasia 2000 grew out of. But I think he was able to, when I did Waking Sleeping Beauty, the documentary that's now on Disney Plus. I asked Jeffrey about that time and he said, you know, we went and saw the pitch for Great Mouse Detective. We went through storyboard after storyboard for about 2 or 3 hours. And then afterwards we were walking away and Michael and I just said, did any of that make sense? He said, no. I said, well, we got like 130 people working on it. I guess we should keep going. Yeah, I guess we should. So it was that sense that, you know, maybe we don't know what we're talking about yet. Roy brought us into the company. Let's give this over to Roy and it'll sort itself out. And thank God it did.
Wow. You know something, we're bumping up on an hour and 15 minutes. And so I'm going to say that we should wrap up in a few moments. Aljon, do we have any questions on Beauty and the Beast hanging in the wings?
Gosh, you know, we have tons of questions, but I know once again, we got to talk about the cast. We have to talk more about the music. Obviously, the companion to this, Don, is the film that you directed. I mean, I feel, and we talked about this too, Dave, is that Howard is just a great documentary, right? And
yes,
talking about
we have shamelessly plugged Howard, Don Hahn's documentary numerous times on the Skull Rock podcast.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just an interesting thing though. You know, you have, you know, yourself with your musical background being a percussionist and then moving your way. I mean, what is it about the producing aspect, because you produce so much prolific work over the course of your career? What is it about producing that you love so much?
I love the artists, you know, full stop. I think as I look back on those movies, I remember the movies and I'm proud of them, but I really remember the people. They are your band of brothers and sisters. And that's what I remember. And to be able to work with them and support them and cheerlead with them. And, you know, sometimes a producer is a therapist and sometimes a coach and, you know, whatever it takes to get it done. But that's what I remember and that's what I love. And I'm not saying it's easy all the time. It's almost never easy, but I love wrangling a group of people and then serving them to try to create a project that together we can do something that no one of us individually could have ever done.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I was going to just ask this question because I kind of know the answers to it. But when you are the producer, you're running interference and you're taking some body blows behind the scenes that the crew never knows about.
Loving it.
No, but I mean, am I correct on that though, Don? I mean, you know, you're shielding the crew from some pretty horrendous things that go on during production.
Yeah, I learned fast that it wasn't all about managing downward. Like, you're not the boss and you're managing all these people. I never thought of myself that way. You're managing upwards and downwards. So upwards is managing expectations, setting up executives for when they come into the room, this, this, and this will happen. I mean, we were really good at that. We would say, Roy, you're coming into the room and we think this is broken. If you agree, we need you to say that. You know, we would really set up the executives, or to say there's a contentious issue coming up with this person. Just a heads up before you walk into the room. Because nobody likes to be blindsided. The same, though, with all the artists working on the movie. You're walking in and you need to tell the artists, you know, this executive really hates this sequence. You better come in loaded for bear to be able to defend that sequence and tell everybody why you think it's important. That's why people like Glenn Keane went to bat for Part of Your World and said, you know, you have to keep this in the movie. It's about Ariel's character. So those are the kinds of things the producer does. You try to tee up everybody for not the perfect conversation all the time, because it never is, but to manage expectations. And then I always like to take kind of a servant attitude, meaning get ahead of people and give them what they need to get the job done and beyond in an unexpected way. That might be a new tool. That might be technology. That might be ambition for creating an animated ballroom in Beauty and the Beast or something like that. Encouraging the directors to take risks, encouraging people not to edit themselves too prematurely in the process or settle for something that's second best when they really need to hang in there and go for a better result. All that stuff is good producing. And the people I look up to as producers were always creative producers, like Jim Henson and Walt Disney. And those guys had a creative way of rallying people around a project that I really admired.
Mm. Wow. That's fantastic. I mean, it's so true, though. I mean, it's amazing. And in particular, you make it look effortless. I mean, it really does look effortlessly done, having been on many pictures with you over the years.
Well, that's years of therapy and pharmaceuticals, I think, really. No, I'm just kidding. I genuinely love these people. You know, I have no problem saying that, because what they do is absolutely incredible. It's like Bumblebee Flight. It's incredible. So to be able to support that kind of talent is a privilege for me.
Well, there we have it. Don Hahn, producer of Beauty and the Beast.
Taking body blows backstage for you as an audience.
That's right. Well, I'm going to say we're going to wrap up this segment, because we're fortunate that, as I said earlier, Don had brought his camping gear and he set up shop in our green room. And we will pull him out next week for another conversation on The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Do you say Notre Dame or Notre Dame?
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. Yes. Mm-hmm. Notre Dame is Indianapolis.
Indianapolis. Yeah. Right. Always good football team.
The Hunchback of the Notre Dame football team. No.
Yeah. Not the Fighting Irish.
Yeah. So next week we'll be talking about, next week we're going to talk Hunchback, and the week after Atlantis, The Lost Empire. And there's so much to talk about. I mean, this was a great conversation, Don. And I want to
thanks, guys. It's fantastic. Thank you for inviting me. I just appreciate it.
Plus, we have to, you know, maybe the next session, Don will put the Pringles down and then, you know, pick up the snare drum and then do a little revelry for us. That would be amazing.
There we go.
I would be happy to do anything like that within the laws of the state of California. Yeah, happy to.
Excellent. All right, Don, we'll see you next week for the Hunchback conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Your attention, please. Now loading on track number one. for a trip around Walt Disney's Magic Kingdom.
Skull Rock Podcast.
All aboard.
Your main street to the world of Disney.
Wowie, wowie, Dave. Wowie. That's a lot.
You know, that was such a great interview. And I just love sitting back and listening to Don's stories. And you know something? Even though I worked on Beauty and the Beast, I heard some things from Don that I hadn't heard before. You know, some behind the scenes stuff that I wasn't privy to. And it was so cool hearing some of that. I love it.
I think you're exactly right. The great thrill for me as a fan, and I don't mean to speak for everybody, but I'll speak for myself, is hearing those great things that you haven't ever heard before. And I think because it's new to you, Dave, because you're so close to all those projects and behind the scenes DVD extras, if you will, that you've produced over the years, it's great that when you hear something new, that it's a complete revelation for the rest of us.
Yeah, no. And you know something, Al John, I have to say, like, you know, there's so many hundreds of artists and production people involved with these movies that you can't be everywhere at every time, you know? So there's certainly things that I'm sure that went on the production that Don wasn't even aware of, mm-hmm. you know, little hijinks or, you know, practical jokes, which was a big thing that went on back in those days, you know? So there was always like this fun stuff. And when you get a group of people that worked on a movie together, you start to hear those little tidbits and say, oh, I didn't know that. Wow. You know, so it's so great to be able to share that with our audience.
Absolutely. I'd like to remind everybody that if you want to follow Don, please check, be our guest, right? And check out all the stuff there at donhahn.com. That's HAHN.com, donhahn.com. And he's got all kinds of info there, all the books that he's done over the years and all the films he's done. Of course, he is, he likes to paint, write, and make movies. It's kind of like his little byline he has on his website. But, you know, what a Renaissance man, as you said earlier at the start of the interview, and just a really great all-around guy.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I have one of Don's paintings. Nancy bought it for me as a gift a couple of years back when Don did a solo show. And guess what? It was called Han Solo.
Oh, where's Don? You know, he's a drummer here. He needs to have the rim shot.
Yeah,
I think exactly. I need to sample that. Don, wherever you are, now that you've gone back into the green room holding cell for the next interview, we got to sample that snare drum shot there for you, the rim shot. So we have it there for comedic timing purposes.
There you go.
Well, Dave, I know that we have, this is a series, a trilogy, if you will, of interviews with Don that are coming up. You want to tell everybody once again what the game plan is?
Yeah, so believe it or not, we are going to have three successive interviews with Don Hahn. Each one is focusing on a movie that's celebrating an anniversary in this year, 2021. So we've got the 30th anniversary of Beauty and the Beast that you just listened to. And the next one up is going to be for The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then we're going to do the anniversary show for Atlantis, The Lost Empire.
There you go. I love it. All great movies, all of them celebrating anniversary milestones this year. Hard to believe it's been that long, but man, they are epics. They are magnificent stories, and we shall relive them with more behind-the-scenes stories from Dave and Don in the coming weeks. I'm looking forward to it. Once again, don't forget, send us those emails, if you will, Aljohn@skullrockpodcast.com or Dave@skullrockpodcast.com. And be sure to leave us those likes. Be sure to share the podcast, subscribe to it, and leave us those reviews. Those 5-star reviews, especially, you know, over Apple Podcasts, are certainly very helpful. And I leave Dave with the final word.
Well, as always, peace and love to you all. Go out into the world, be kind to one another, and please get vaccinated, mask up. Let's get rid of this pandemic so we can get back to normal. Be well and stay safe, and we'll see you next time right here on the Skull Rock Podcast.
I'm Al John Goh, co-host of the Disney List podcast as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they'd want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com.
Skull Rock Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. We'd love to thank Charles, Lindsay, Spencer, and Joshua. To support this podcast to sustain future episodes, visit anchor.fm/Skull Rock Podcast.
I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List Podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.
I'm Kristen Hetzel, co-host of Dining at Disney Podcast. Every week, I chat about dining at Disneyland and Walt Disney World Resort and Disney Cruise Line with my fellow foodie, Bubba. We also feature restaurants and food reviews, information to help you plan your dining, Disney food news, recipes, and a monthly panel discussion. Visit diningatdisney.com and subscribe to Dining at Disney Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. Dining at Disney Podcast, the happiest plate on earth.